This is an interview with Charles Whittington. This interview is being conducted on the 18th of November, 2011, at the Museum of Seminole County History. The interviewer is Joseph Morse, representing the Linda McKnight Batman Oral History Project for the Historical Society of Central Florida. Sir, could you tell us about where and when you were born?
Yes, I was born in Seminole County in Sanford at the old Vernal Lawton Sanford Hospital, and that was in March of 1938. The building is still standing, and the last time I was by there, it was used as a halfway house of sorts. I'm not really sure, and I'm not well informed on that, but that was my understanding. But it is still there. It's across from the old Sanford Library.
Okay, sir. And can you describe the place where you grew up?
Yes, I was. My dad owned a Sinclair gas station at the corner of Park Avenue and 2nd, and we had a little home on Oak Avenue. When World War II broke out in 1942, my dad was offered a job as a machinist in the Navy shipyard in Charleston, South Carolina. And we moved up there, and my dad worked in a division of the shipyard that later became the test bed for our first nuclear research into nuclear-powered ships. And it was highly classified and very structured, and he didn't understand why at the time, and I didn't either until later. Realized that no wonder it was top secret. I mean, because this was our first involvement in nuclear research for, you know, powering anything. And then in the latter part of 1943, my dad had saved enough money to come back here and buy a farm. We bought a little 13-acre farm on Richmond Avenue and moved down there. And my dad, it was sort of a lifelong dream for him, went into farming. And at that time, primarily, we grew celery and corn and cabbage, other crops that could be shipped up north. But the days of the small farmer in Seminole County toward the end of that decade, the end of the 40s, was starting pretty rapidly to come to an end. The soil was worn out, and much of the farming had moved to the Everglades, to the area around Lake Okeechobee. And my dad hung on and tried to make it, and he finally realized that we were going under and that this just wasn't going to do it for us. And we sold a farm and moved to Pasco County down near Tampa, and he got back into the poultry industry there and did, you know, quite well. But I hated to leave. I loved Sanford. I loved being raised on a small farm, and it was a big disappointment for me to leave Sanford, especially in my sophomore year in high school. And the two schools were just as, you know, much different as night and day, the high school here and the high school down there. The one down there wouldn't come anywhere near to the quality of what we had here in Sanford. And I miss that very much. And I come back to Seminole County as often as I can, and that's why I'm here today for this interview, and also to meet with some former classmates. And I still feel like this is my hometown, but it's also, if anyone asks me where I'm from, it's always Sanford, not Zephyr Hills.
Okay, sir. And you said your dad, prior to World War II, he ran or owned a
Sinclair gas station.
A gas station. What happened to that when he moved to South Carolina for the machinist job?
He sold it to someone else, and the station now is the office of Edward Jones, investment agency, and Bill Kirchhoff had that, and I believe he has been here and talked to you folks. And he and I are good friends. Matter of fact, I've got a tractor radiator cap for him. I've got to get to him after our interview.
Okay, sir.
But his dad was involved in the overall agricultural structure of Seminole County during the time that we had the farm on Richmond Avenue. And he raised gladiolas in Florida and also in New York. And I think he even had some farms on the West Coast. And he would, you know, follow the seasons. And also there was a problem with a little microbe in the soil here called a nematode that was not present in the soil of New York because, you know, the soil freezes up there in the winter and kills these things. And here it doesn't freeze, and these little guys do pretty well, and they really wreak havoc on both celery plants and gladiola bulbs.
These were nematodes, you said?
Nematodes, okay. Right. It's a little microbe, and they attack the roots of the young plants.
How did you counter those when you were farming?
You would flood the area. You would dam in a little area of the farm that would be the area for the seed beds where the young celery plants were growing, and flood it for about 2.5 weeks. And just keep, you know, a couple inches of water on it, and with the well running in there, you know, all the time. And keep the water in there for about 2.5 weeks, and that would kill the nematodes in this area. And you would raise your young celery plants in seed beds in this area. And once the plants got up to, you know, a height of like, you know, 3 or 4 inches, they could deal with these little bugs. But it was the little bitty plants that they would go after.
And when they were the little bitty plants, that's when you flooded? Or did you flood and then plant?
You flooded, then planted.
Okay.
You would flood, drain it, and form the seed beds and plant those. And I've got pictures I'll send you, too. You had to put muslin covers over the seed beds because when the plants first came up, they were very sensitive to sun. So you had to keep them covered during the hot part of the day. And in the afternoon, you would open the side of the cover along all the way to halfway through the field and let fresh air and sunlight in with the sun over here. And in the morning, you would open, you know, the back side, the other side, the west side, and get air and sunlight in there, but not direct sunlight. Because they were very, very, a celery plant is a very tender little guy when it's, you know, when it's an inch high.
Okay, and the sun just be too strong for it.
Yeah, it would just burn them up, and they just couldn't handle it.
Did you have to do that when the little celery grew up?
No, or, once it got up to a height of maybe 2 or 3 inches, then you could take the cover off, and it was okay then. But it was just when they were first starting and first coming up that they were so sensitive to the sun.
Okay. What other kind of problems did you have while raising celery, other than the sunlight and other than the microbes? Was there any other kind of difficulty that you would have to, you found out about?
Well, the main difficulty would be weather during the, you know, the winter months when you planted celery typically wasn't an issue, but the real issue was the market price of the celery when you harvested it. You know, if it was good, why, you did okay, and if it was bad, you know, it was just another bad year. And
what affected these what would change from year to year that would make it a good year or bad year for selling celery?
Well, just the market price in New York. That was where we shipped. We shipped from the Sanford Farmers Market, usually to New York and that, you know, the New England area. And it was just the price of celery up there that, you know, was whether you made it that year or not. And we had too many of the and not yours.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was your involvement? Like, how old were you when you moved to the farm, and what was your involvement while you lived there?
Well, I was 5 years old when we moved there, and we started farming with a pair of mules. Now, this is how far back it goes. We used mules for plowing and disking, cultivation, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And after this, we bought a Model F Fordson tractor. I've got a picture of this, and there are several online now. And my dad would let me drive it, but it was so hard to steer that until I was about 12 years old, I could not turn it around at the end of the row. It took that much power to turn the steering wheel. And also, I didn't weigh enough to push the clutch in. The clutch was a lever that stuck out of the transfer case, and you had to press down on it, and I could stand on it, and it wouldn't go anywhere. So, obviously, I couldn't operate the Fordson by myself.
Right.
We later got rid of that and got a Model 8N Ford, and that's the radiator cap for one I have in my car. And it was, you know, power steering and a hydraulic lift in the back and so forth. And so I did a lot of plowing and disking and running the tractor.
From the time
I was, you know, 10 years old, I did a lot of it. That was my part of helping.
No planting or harvesting necessarily?
No. We, for harvesting the celery crops, we usually used crews of laborers that we would hire locally. And they would plant the celery and also cabbage or a couple other plants that required, you know, physical planting. And then they would also do the harvesting and packing. And you contacted a crew leader or a team leader and contracted with him to do the harvesting in your field. And we were just responsible really for, you know, making certain that the celery, if it was the celery or whatever the crop, was sprayed in case there was any kind of a blight or a fungus or some sort of an insect problem, that we sprayed it with the proper spray and that we fertilized it. And also cultivated the rows to keep the weeds down. And it was a very labor-intensive occupation. And I was very upset with my dad, especially in later years, because he could have stayed on forever. He already had his foot in the door in the nuclear, the government nuclear involvement in the military. And he didn't even know it. I mean, he knew he was under a very tight security environment, but he didn't know why. But he was an excellent machinist. He was moved up shop chief in no time at all, making good money, but his dream was always come back to Sanford and own a farm. And, I mean, it was quite obvious that by the end of, you know, the 40s that, hey, farming here was in trouble. And, you know, in later years, I thought, Pop, why couldn't you have just stayed at Charleston with the Navy and, you know, gotten a civil service retirement? And we wouldn't have, you know, been in the situation that we found ourselves in here. Although, like I say, I dearly love Sanford and love growing up here.
Okay. A little bit of a catch-22.
That was a very good comparison there.
Now, you said you moved to Sanford when you were five.
Uh-huh.
How long was your dad a machinist for the Navy? Because I know when he moved up to South Carolina, you must have been only a couple years old.
Right.
So he's only.
Well, I was born in 38, mm-hmm. and we moved up there in 42.
Okay.
And he worked for about 18 months and put everything aside, and that was enough to buy that farm, and so we came back, and plus he had sold the gas station by this time, and he had some income from that, and so he put it all in that farm and getting some equipment,
and mules.
Yeah, and the mules. Yeah, we had mules, and then the Fordson, and then the Model 80 in Ford, which I'm trying to find. I got a couple leads on it, but I'd like to run it down and get some pictures of it.
Okay. So I'm kind of surprised, because when you moved to Sanford, World War II was still going on.
Right.
And they didn't have a problem coming from a very heavily secured area, and during a World War II, an able-bodied man. I'm surprised he was able to leave his job and come and become a farmer.
That's an excellent point, and I would be surprised at it, except that farming was a fairly high priority occupation as far as the government was concerned, because you were feeding, you were feeding the population and providing some foods that could be used in preparation of foods for our military.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the fact that we came back here and we're going into farming wasn't a problem. And my dad had served in World War I in France.
Oh, okay.
And he was past the draft age. So that was something else too. I mean, he was too old for required military service.
And what was the cap at this time for age? The age cap before you could no longer be drafted?
Sure, I don't remember exactly. I think somewhere in the 30s, like 35.
Okay.
I believe that was it. I'll do some checking and get back to you on that.
Thank you, sir.
I believe that was in mid 30s.
I was a little surprised they let such an excellent machinist, leave so easily.
Well,
unless they put up a fight trying to entice him and keep him to stay.
Yeah.
But it just seemed during World War II to let him go to farming. I mean, maybe they didn't have any say in the matter as well. I that's just where my question was going.
Right, and I really wish that of the many things that you want to go back and ask your parents, it's something I'd really like to talk to my dad about is why you left. I mean, was farming that important to you that you would leave, a high-tech, high-paying, secure job like that and go back into something that, almost going in, it was a known gamble because it was problems with weather and insects and, always the market fluctuations.
Did he like his career as a machinist?
Yes, he did. I mean, he liked that very much, but it didn't have the pull that, being his own boss in farming did.
I guess maybe it could have been just his own culture growing up, attached significance to farming and independence.
Right. Well, he was raised on a farm in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
So, that was where his roots were, and he wanted to get back into it down here. And, of course, in the 30s, Sanford couldn't produce enough celery. I mean, it was the silver capital of the world.
Right.
And some of that aura sort of hung over for quite some time that, get a farm and get celery growing and you'll get rich. Well, it didn't always work out that way.
Shoot.
But anyway, that was...
How long did your family own the farm?
We sold the farm in 1950, and he leased another farm, and we stayed on until 1953. And at Christmas that year, at my sophomore year in high school, we left and went to Zephyr Hills.
So how long did you live then in Sanford from the first farm up until that? 1953?
Okay, I was born here, and we lived here until we left in 1942, and then in the early part of 1942, and then toward the latter part of 1943, we came back. So I was only gone like 18 months.
Okay.
And then we stayed here until 1953, and I was a sophomore in high school at that time.
Okay, sir. Then... I know we've talked a little about your father. Could you tell me more about your parents and any kind of siblings?
Mm-hmm. I had one sister that was 17 years older than I was. And she graduated from Florida State, which was Florida College for Women back then, and with a degree in education. And she went to Melbourne and got a teaching job there. And when World War One or World War Two started, the city of Melbourne offered her the directorship of the USO that they built in Melbourne for mainly the sailors, because there's a lot of Navy and Coast Guard, you know, at least there were activities at that time in that area. And so Melbourne built a nice USO and offered my sister a job to run that, and she took it and did that until the war ended. And my dad had a couple years of mechanical engineering at NC State, and that's why he did well at Charleston, because he had that already, had some college training in you know, the math end of mechanical engineering. And well, it's primarily math, but his roots in North Carolina of being raised on a small farm just were too strong, and he wanted to go back to it. And plus he had the problem that a lot of folks have of not wanting to work for somebody else. That's why he ran the gas stations, because, you know, he was his own boss there, and you know, he could hire somebody else to help him, but he didn't report to anybody else. He was his own station, and he ran it the way he wanted to.
Okay. And what about your mother, sir?
My mother helped my dad a lot. I mean, farming was sort of a family thing that you got into, because, I mean, there was just so much to be done that my mother frequently would help, not only, you know, taking care of running the home, but she would actually physically help with some of the labor on the farm itself. And I didn't like that. It just seemed wrong that a woman should be, you know, having to make ends meet, to have to work, you know, on the farm. Even though it was not really heavy labor work, it was the fact that she still had to chip in and help us to make it. That bothered me. But she did, and never complained about it. But it was, you know, it was something that many families here did. The whole family was involved in farming. And I didn't mind, you know, running the tractor at all. I liked it. I mean, that was... especially the Ford that I could handle, not the big Ford, but the little one that was newer. And
well, sir, how has Sanford changed over the years? How has Sanford changed over the years?
How's it
from
changed?
When you grew up to
okay.
How it is now, sir?
Well, the change that I noticed when I first came back was the decline of the downtown area, which is so typical of many small towns. The shopping moves out to shopping centers in the suburbs, and that has happened. I mean, downtown Sanford is a perfect example of it, because we had downtown, we had a Firestone store and a J.C. Penney, and a Lerner clothing store, and a McCrory's Five and Dime. I can't think of two hardware stores, some regional area chain department stores, and two banks. And it was just, you know, it was a very functional little downtown area. And you could see that starting to go. You know, stores would close and be empty, and then somebody else would try something else on it, and they wouldn't make it. Now it's, you know, there's a lot of antique shops down there, and that's about it. I mean, that's that whole main street is antique shops. And I didn't like to see that. The old telephone company was over the J.C. Penney store. There was an old manual switchboard with operators. Mm-hmm. The second floor of the J.C. Penney building. And then there was the Touchton drugstore on one corner and the Rumlin Anderson drugstore on the other. There were no Target or Pharmacy or CVS, any of those. You know, there were none of the chain stores. The Eckerd chain was the first one down here, Eckerd and Walgreens. But, you know, during my growing up years, those two were places where you hung out and you could get a hamburger and a malt or, you know, whatever. And also there was a pharmacy there. And I hated to see those go, because that was, you know, that was just a very active part of Sanford.
Okay, sir. And where have you lived over the course of your life?
Well, after I got discharged from the hospital following that jet accident in the Air Force, I immediately went right back to the Cape and applied with NASA and got on. This was during the Gemini program. I got on at the flight simulator over at the Cape, and I worked the NASA contracts. I was at Houston twice. I was in Ecuador for one time, and then at a tracking station in the Smoky Mountains, and was there through, after the end of the Skylab program, when that ended, and the shuttle program wasn't yet, we'd gone to the moon and done that thing with the Apollo series. And the shuttles weren't flying yet, so there was a massive layoff. I got caught in that. And I got into the telecom industry and followed that all over the country as a contractor. And I found that I could, of course, you weren't building any pension or retirement, but I found that I could make more money than a company employee. I could make more as a contractor if I was willing to move around. And you just had to discipline yourself and put aside what would have otherwise been your retirement from the company. Mm-hmm. And I did that and did all right. And I like to travel. But I ended up in an ISP, internet hosting outfit in Seattle, and was doing that when I retired in 2001. You know, the travel and, the changes and the challenges of new jobs and being able to go to a new area and move into a new company and a new job, that part of moving around was attractive to me. But,
what kind of places did you move to, sir?
Okay, I was in San Francisco, and it was there during the earthquake, and was in Los Angeles, and then in the Seattle area for about 10 years. And then prior to that, I had moved around just for a few months at a time in various places in all over the U.S. I was in Indianapolis and Chicago, for like maybe 6 weeks or 2 months at a time on just a contract job. And it was interesting, but I was single then and just, pull up and move without any real concern. And it was okay.
You said you like to travel, sir. Have you ever traveled outside the country or vacation travel?
Yeah, I've traveled to the South America travel was mainly as a function of the military and NASA time, but I've traveled to England and done the Hawaiian Islands, was in Israel in Tel Aviv for 5 weeks for a company school, and that was an eye-opener, that really was. I mean, I got a good look at the Holy Land, and It was a lot different than I expected. It really was.
How so, sir?
Well, those people have got an unreal I'm talking about the Israelis, they've got an unreal work ethic. I mean, if they are asked to work 24 hours a day and there's a need for it, they'll do it, and no griping. You don't find that very, very much here in the U.S. I mean, they are very, very much, I can't really express myself here, loyal to Israel and to their faith and to the country. I mean, just, you know, they've got a country and they're going to hang on to it now. And the the guys around them had better not mess with them. I can say that from being there and being in their technology. I know what they've got. And the guys around them can end up a big smoking hole in the ground over there. If, you know, they push Israel too hard. They might hurt Israel too, but they'll come out the losers.
And have you traveled anywhere else, sir? For work or vacation? Said South America, what countries?
Okay, I've been over a good bit of England. Mm-hmm. And I was in Alaska, and I was in the army up there, like that. But I've been back just as a tourist with my wife, and took my in-laws up there, and the Hawaiian Islands several times. I've not done China. I'd like to see China. I really would. And that's kind of the feeling I got, because there was a contract that Chinese were going to completely replace their aging landline system with
towers?
With a tower network, okay. Yeah, with towers and cell phones. And several different companies had some pretty good contracts over there if you'd go and stay for as long as you could take it. But some of the places I heard about, you know, they were all right, and some were pretty Spartan. I mean, food and accommodations. And you having been there, you would probably validate some of that. I don't know.
Some of it, sir. The when was this going on? When were these contracts for your line work?
Okay, the contracts for China were like in the mid-90s.
Okay, sir.
There were some openings there. And that kind of moved around. It would change a lot. And I never could get somebody to, you know, sit down with me and say, okay, you know, here's what we can offer you, and here's when you leave. I never was able to find it at that point. And perhaps it's a good thing, but anyway, I've not been there. I've got a good friend that my wife worked with in San Francisco and Seattle that is from Ethiopia. Oh, not Ethiopia. Let's say it starts with E and was part of the Soviet Union. Oh, fiddle.
Is this in Africa or in
no,
Asia?
No, it's in...
Is this Estonia?
Yeah, Estonia. Okay. I couldn't say it. And he's gone back to Russia several times. And the pictures and so forth and the stories that I got from him when I would talk to him afterwards, I don't really have any desire to travel in Russia. I mean, that's not one of the things I'd want to do. I'd want to do Europe first and really work it over really good. And Hong Kong and Japan. Those are ones that I really want to...
They're both very nice. are you still working right now?
No, I'm retired now.
Oh, okay, so how long have you been retired, sir?
I retired in 2001.
Okay. And what have you been doing to, you know, kill your time since then, sir?
Okay, I'm very much into researching my ancestry, into genealogy. I've got a solid trace back now to, I don't know if you ever heard the story of Dick Whittington and his cat.
No,
but,
sir.
This was a guy who was Lord Mayor of London four different times. And anyway, he was a far distant cousin. And I've gone 200 years past him with a solid trace back. And that was a lot of fun. And I think I've got my own family tree built now. I'm working my wife's and just anybody else that pops up. I thought, well, let's just see what, theirs looks like. That's a lot of fun. I've been in ham radio for, well, since I was 11 years old. And that technology keeps advancing. I mean, we were digital before digital phones were, the thing. We were bouncing, signals off the moon, communicating that way. We've got a whole bunch of satellites up. Not our satellites, but we've got ham radio equipment piggybacked on a lot of satellites that are up there. So you can stand out with a little handheld and talk to somebody on the other side of the earth. And that to me is fascinating. So that's been something that's kept me really busy in my time is ham radio. And my wife and I like to travel. And if we get a few days that we see we can get away and do something, we get in the car and go. And that's, we had a great big map when we were in California, a huge plasticized ceiling to floor map of the whole state. And when I was there, I was able to take off, and be gone for a week at a time with no charge against any vacation time because I was on duty 7x24 out there. It didn't require that much support, but I had to be there. So if I wanted to leave, they'd fly one of the managers out there to watch my equipment because it was a little vacation for him to San Francisco, and we'd take off. And we went to little towns. We'd just find this map and say, let's go there this weekend. And we'd go to little towns in California that the average California had never heard of and go and spend the night, or sometimes not spend the night, just go and come back. And the travel was a big thing out there, especially in the mountains. I mean, of course, California's got a lot of them, and that was an interesting thing.
Okay, sir.
I was involved in the Voyager aircraft project that flew around the world non-refueled, non-stop. It was the Burt Rutan-designed Canard weird-looking airplane. And I worked on that for about 2.5 months or 2.5 years as a volunteer on the staff before the world record flight. And they wanted me for my NASA background because I knew how to solder without putting a lot of weight in the airplane and solder. Because they proved that if you improperly, if the crews that built the big Saturn spacecraft that we used to go to the moon, they used too much solder, you could end up with 5 tons of solder in the spacecraft and it would never get off the pad. And so there's a very finite point in soldering where you have just barely enough, but not too much solder. And I had an instructor's certificate for hand soldering for aerospace flight hardware. And the Voyager crew wanted me for that reason, that I keep the weight down when we put something in the plane, in the wiring and the way it was hooked up. And
And what was this again, sir? Like, what time? Can you give me a time frame?
This was from like 84 through the plane flew in 87. It was those years.
Okay, sir.
And they were up for just under 10 days, but they flew all the way around, nonstop from Edwards Air Force Base back to Edwards Air Force Base in California, nonstop and non-refueled.
Did you enjoy working for NASA and with NASA projects?
Oh yeah, I was very much into that. And I also enjoyed the work when I was assigned it to Patrick over at the Cape because we were supporting the NASA effort. And we were right on the cutting edge of everything there. And that was extremely fascinating and challenging. And it was the kind of a job you'd go into early, not to be on overtime because you couldn't go and just clock on arbitrarily, but just to be part of it. And I worked the midnight shift, and a lot of times I'd still be over there at noon just hanging around watching stuff, you know, just to be part of it. And, you know, it just, you'd realize, hey, I've got to go home and get some sleep. And sometimes they'd run you out, you know, there were too many of us hanging around, but it was extremely fascinating.
And so you mentioned your wife. How long have you been married, and who is she, and where did you meet her?
Okay, my first wife I met here locally. She was from Plant City, and we were married 16 years, and got a divorce. I was divorced 12 years, and I met my second wife in Zephyr Hills, and she was with a company in California that provided mortgage insurance. It was part of this thing that was, it kept the housing bubble sort of going, because it allowed you to buy a home with mortgage insurance instead of a much larger down payment. And it was a good concept. There was nothing underhanded about it. But anyway, she had 20 years with them. And she was in charge of a team that would go to the various offices around the country and underwrite, you know, maybe 500 loans at one time, but be there a week. And as such, you know, they flew constantly, and we always had a whole stack of frequent flyer tickets on the dresser. And we flew to England, to Ecuador, to Hawaii, to Alaska twice on frequent flyer passes, and took her folks to Alaska. And she enjoyed her work and enjoyed the travel, and I enjoyed being able to grab some of those tickets and say, well, let's go to jolly old England.
That must have been very convenient.
It was neat.
And do you have any children, sir?
Yes, I do. I have a daughter and two boys. And my daughter lives in Brooksville, and the boys are in the Atlanta area.
What are their names and ages, sir?
Okay, my daughter is 46 now, and the oldest boy is 44, and the youngest one is 37. So they're getting up there.
Are they all from the first marriage?
They're all from the first marriage, right.
Okay, sir. And are they doing anything similar to what you did?
No. My daughter worked as a... she did hematology studies for Smith Kline Beecham in veterinary medicine. And I thought she was going to stay with it because it was, you know, it was an excellent field. And she got out and got into, of all things... running a business, and she's got a fairly large one. But have you noticed on the freeways, you'll see a large load being hauled on the freeway, and there's a truck ahead of it with a flashing light, one behind it, called a pilot car?
Yes, sir.
So she has a pilot car operation in Brooksville, and she's the biggest company east of the Mississippi. And she covers the whole country. I mean, she's got contract drivers for all over the country, that one driver can take the load from here to there, and then somebody else picks it up and goes on. And she even had a contract with NASA to escort those solid rocket boosters from the West Coast to the Cape. And, you know, this was, she was, you know, she said, well, Dad will be proud of this. And I was, and, she asked, they would always, when they would ship these boosters back, they would send two engineers from the plant with them, because they were very critical insofar as temperature and pressures and so forth went, even though they were solid fuel. And one of the engineers told her one time, he said, if you see smoke coming out of the casing for one of those boosters, run. And she said, right, sir, but let me ask a question. Which way? And I thought her sarcastic humor was a little bit funny. That's, you know, really, which way is it going to go if it pops, you know? But anyway, she does that. And the oldest boy regrettably had a stroke a couple years ago and is, you know, he won't be working anymore. And the young one works for a granite quarry in Atlanta, the north side of Atlanta, and driving a truck, a dump truck. So,
very eclectic.
Yeah, but okay. He's still, even in this economy, he's still staying employed, so, you know, more power to him, you know.
Definitely, sir. Could you tell us a little about your military experience?
Military experience. The first one, I was in the Army, and they sent me to Indianapolis for court reporter training. And I thought, wow, you know, court reporter. And after 4 months there of learning to transcribe, you know, court proceedings, they sent three of us to Alaska, and we got up there, and they had civil service court reporters and no need for us. So they assigned me to the Army dock in downtown Anchorage. And it was one of those dream tours that you get one of in the service. There were seven of us assigned there. There was a captain and two NCOs, and the rest of us were enlisted. And during the summer months when the port was open and, you know, real busy, you'd work sometimes 36 hours straight. And during the winter months when it was frozen up and closed, you pulled CQ or watch for 24 hours and, you know, you were off 48. Well, it wasn't missile science for us to get together and say, hey guys, let's pull it for a week straight and take 2 weeks off. So I left at the ski bowl. I mean, I did. I love skiing. And during the winter months, you know, I'd work for a week and then that was it. They wouldn't see me again until 2 week time was by.
You have to be awake for a week straight, sir?
Oh, well, you wouldn't have to be awake. You'd just have to be on duty there. The place was closed up and frozen over, really. And you just had to be there and answer the phone. That's all.
Okay.
And sort of pull fire watch and whatever.
No, I understand.
But you didn't do anything. There were only two TV stations in Anchorage at that time. And
a lot of reading then, sir?
You did a lot of reading. And
copping world events.
But anyway, I should have stayed in. I mean, I made E4 after 18 months. And I had my private license at that time. And if you had any college at all, I had 1 year at Southern, Florida Southern, you could apply for the warrant officer program, go to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and get helicopter training. And I always wanted a rotary wing rating. I mean, I wanted a chopper rating. But some little boy said, don't do it. Because if I had, I'd have been one of the first Huey pilots in Vietnam.
Yeah.
One of the first, because this was in 1959, and I would have gotten through warrant officer school and flight training by about 1961. And Vietnam was just starting to stir about then. And a good friend from high school here was the first commissioned officer killed in Vietnam, Terry Cordell. First one killed over there. Hmm. And I knew Terry. He was our football captain. And he was a senior and I was a freshman. Just a real nice guy. But flying an observation plane, got shot down. That was the end of Terry.
And then you got out of the Army.
Got out of the Army in 1959. And enlisted in the Air Force in 62 and was in there until July of 64 when I got the medical discharge. And I was actually, I don't even like to tell people about it, but in when I saw the end of the NASA thing coming, the Army had a program at that time called Stripes for Skills. And they offered me an E5 and choice of assignment, which I took Denver, Colorado, based on my NASA background. And they wanted somebody that had some comm satellite experience, which I did. And so the deal was that I'd go through a little 3-week refresher basic, and then would be assigned to Denver, Colorado as an E5. And they enlisted my wife at the same time. This was my first wife. She had court reporter experience, and they would put her through the same program, and she would have to go through the full WAC basic, but then they would assign us both together to the same base, and in as much as they could, you know, the military would keep us together. But at that time, I'd had a medical discharge, I had 3 kids, I was overage, I had all kind of disqualifiers. And a retired general in the little town there where I was working for NASA said, "Go to the Pentagon." And like a dummy, I climbed in the car and we headed off to the Pentagon. And got there at 8 o'clock in the morning and got in with a crowd that, was going into work. And I fell in with this bird colonel and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I need to see the Army G2. And he says, "Oh, yeah?" He couldn't believe this. I mean, me and my wife and three kids. I mean, it blew him away so badly that he took us in and signed us in. And he says, "And you stay right here." And finally, somebody from that office came down and they saw this guy sitting there. And he said, what do you want?" I said, "I want a waiver for the disqualifiers that are keeping me out of the Minuteman program." And I talked to the guy for about an hour. And I've got the letter that waives my disqualifications to go back in the Army. This was after a medical discharge, 3 kids, and overage. But anyway, I went to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, went through this little basic training, which was kind of fun, learning the new weapons and new techniques and stuff. And then everybody else left and no assignment. Another guy and I were there by ourselves in the outfit, and just the cadre people were still there. And finally they came through and they said, "We hate to admit it, but the Army has enlisted about 10 people in that career field for every slot we have." And he said, the company commander said, "We can't offer you Denver, Colorado, or Fort," I can't think of the base there now, but he said, "We can offer you Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, and E3, and no concurrent assignment with your wife." And I said, "Or what else?" And he said, "Or a discharge." And I said, "Let's go with plan B." So I've got a very short second enlistment in the Army.
After all that trouble.
After all that trouble, yeah.
Shoot.
But I didn't really like the changes I'd seen in the Army either at that time. I just, I don't know, it just, there was a change in discipline and attitudes and stuff that I would have had trouble with because of coming from the Army of the late 50s to the Army of the mid 70s. And, I mean, there were guys, you know, even in the training barracks, sitting up there in the dark smoking pot. And it was, I mean, I'm not that much against pot, but it was just against Army regulations and against common sense. And it was things like that. And I was just as glad that, you know, it didn't work out, because I'm sure that would have gotten me in trouble complaining about it those kind of issues later on. So it's just well that I didn't end up in that.
Okay, sir. And was that the end of your military experience then?
That was the end of it. Okay.
Yeah. Are there any historical events that come to mind over the course of your entire life, sir? Like anything that stands out in your life that you felt was, you know, that just changed your world, I guess I could say?
Well, being on the biomed console at Houston for the flight of Apollo 8, the slingshot flight around the moon, that to me was, it was just sort of a highlight in my life because I was part of something that it was a first for us, for the U.S., that we were going to the moon, and albeit a small part, I was part of it. And I was just so impressed that the guys in the spacecraft, I was watching all their you know, their biomedical functions, and I had no medical training at all. I was there being able to feed the biomed data that was being stripped out of the telemetry to anyone in mission control that needed it for any reason. All they had to do was call me and say, give me biomed, and I could patch that data to them. And I had to keep the equipment that stripped it out of the telemetry downstream, had to keep that up and running. And it was real fussy stuff because it was built very hurriedly. But I was watching all of their, you know, their vital signs, and Frank Borman, Colonel Frank Borman, the mission commander's pulse at T-minus 2 was 80, and mine was way over 100. I mean, I was wound up. We're going to the moon! And here he's up there, okay, well, that's, I'm going to go, you know. And I just thought, wow, the ultimate test pilot, you know, that the thing can blast into a million pieces. And, you know, he was ready to take a chance on it.
Okay, but, sir, that's interesting.
That's sort of a highlight. And the time in Israel was, that too was a definite attitude adjuster for me. Because, you know, seeing the way those people lived, the way they felt about their country and their faith and everything, it just... And I felt that every American Jew really, they can't now because of the mess over there, but I felt that back then they should spend some time in the Holy Land and see, you know, where they came from, and get an experience with the people that still live there. Because the attitudes over here are a lot more lax and whatever than they are in Israel.
Definitely, sir. Is there anything you'd like to discuss that we haven't covered?
That's about it. It's been a real pleasure discussing this with you.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
And, you know, if you can send me a CD or something, I'd love to have it for the record.
I will definitely do that, sir.
Okay.